طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. We are pleased to announce that beginning this coming week, This Week in Palestine also will be broadcast every Thursday morning on community radio station KKRN, serving Round Mountain, Bernie, and Redding, California. If you want to stream the program live on Thursday morning, on your browser, go to kkrn.org at 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 8 a.m. Pacific Time and stream it live. We, of course, will continue our broadcast in the Boston area at the regular time of 8 a.m. Sunday morning on 90.3 FM. Nothing changes in the Boston area. But This Week in Palestine is now bi-coastal. We begin this week with the voice of Nora Erekat, a frequent guest on This Week in Palestine. She is a Palestinian attorney and professor at Rutgers University and the cousin of Ahmad Erekat, who was recently gunned down and left unattended to bleed to death at a checkpoint in the West Bank on his way to pick up his sister on her wedding day. Here is how Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman covered the story.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the quarantine report. I am Amy Goodman in New York. Juan Gonzalez joins us from New Brunswick, New Jersey, from his home during this time of the coronavirus. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we're going to begin today in Israel and the West Bank. Israeli officers on Tuesday shot dead a Palestinian man at a checkpoint in the occupied West Bank as he was on his way to pick up his sister, who is set to be married that last night. A warning to our viewers, this story contains graphic footage. The video from the scene shows 27-year-old Ahmad Erekat bleeding but still alive on the street where he was shot. He's the nephew of senior Palestinian official Saeb Erekat, the secretary general of the Palestine Liberation Organization, who said his nephew was, quote, murdered in cold blood, and wrote in a tweet that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is responsible for his death. Ahmad Erekat's family said he was killed while on his way to a beauty salon to pick up his sister and his mother. But Israeli authorities claim he tried to run over an officer at a checkpoint in the Palestinian village of Abu Dis, east of Jerusalem. His family rejects the allegations, is calling for Israeli authorities to release security footage. Ahmad himself was also due to be married soon. His killing comes nearly a month after another Palestinian man was killed in similar circumstances near Ramallah, also in the West Bank, and as Netanyahu plans to start annexing nearly a third of the occupied West Bank next month. For more, we're joined by Ahmad Erekat's cousin, Nora Erekat, who's a Palestinian human rights attorney and legal scholar, assistant professor at Rutgers University, author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. Nora, our condolences to you and your family. This is such a terrible time for you. We so deeply appreciate you're able to join us. This is just hours after your cousin was killed. Can you describe the circumstances under which you understand he died?
Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Juan. And to the viewers, I haven't had a chance to speak to his parents, so I want to start out by saying we understand the circumstances to be what people know. Ahmad was on his way from Abu Dis to Bethlehem to pick up his sister, from a hair salon for her wedding. Her mom was there with her. You know, on the way to the hair salon, he passed through a checkpoint separating Bethlehem from Abu Dis through a known roadway, back roadway, a dangerous one known as Wadi Nar, or Valley of Fire. There is a steep decline between this checkpoint on the road. And what we understand is that Ahmed lost control of his car or was confused while he was in his car. That was all it took to have a knee-jerk reaction for the car to jerk a little bit and immediately to cause the soldiers to open fire on him multiple times. Note that these soldiers who are fully armed at this checkpoint are behind barriers, are not actually out in the open, and then left Ahmed to bleed for 1.5 hours. We also understand that his father, Abu Faisal, was there pleading with the Israeli soldiers to let him access his son. We also know that the Palestinian Red Crescent, the equivalent of the Red Cross, was not allowed access. And for 1.5 hours, as you saw in that inexplicable video, Ahmed was left writhing and bleeding out without the ability to care for him. And what is very obvious is the ease and the callousness with which this happened, the way that it's normalized completely. And there's a Palestinian, there's a line, a queue of Palestinian cars. And the one filming this, who's praying over Ahmed as he's dying, should remind us that even those Palestinians who are bearing witness to this are subject to a state of forced helplessness. They are not even allowed to help Ahmed in that moment. I want to just bring up something, Amy, to the audience before I address Israel's vicious, dangerous, and disgusting allegations that this was a car ramming, and raise three questions for the audience that's paying attention right now. Right now is, one, why is Abu Dis, where Ahmed and my family is from, so severely underdeveloped that he has to travel outside to one of the big Palestinian cities in order to get his sisters from a hair salon? What is the cause of that underdevelopment? Number two, I want to ask the audience to think about the biggest Palestinian city and commercial center to Abu Dis is Jerusalem. Abu Dis is a suburb of Jerusalem and has been cut off from it by the apartheid wall. Why can't Palestinians, why couldn't my family get to Jerusalem and instead have to travel to Bethlehem? And number three, and so importantly, why is there a checkpoint between Bethlehem and Abu Dis, two Palestinian cities? Why are there checkpoints anywhere? Just think about those questions as we answer this broader question of the context that Ahmed was killed in.
And Nora, that last point that you, first of all, my deepest condolences to you and your family. But I wanted to precisely ask that question. What are these checkpoints that are within Palestinian territory that apparently are not even near any Israeli settlements? How many of them are there? And what is the justification for them from Israel's perspective?
Thank you for that question. The Palestinian checkpoint, the checkpoints that divide Palestinians from one another and that separate them from their homes, are an invention of the peace process. In 1995, the Palestinian West Bank and Gaza were separated into three jurisdictions, A, B, and C, demarking what was under full Israeli civil and military control and what was under some shared control. Note that Area C, or 60% of the West Bank, is the largest area. It is what is now being marked for annexation, and it is what came under full Israeli civil and security control. The checkpoints that are erected are meant to police Palestinians from traveling from amongst their cities and with one another, and they are placed precisely to divide Palestinians from one another in order to delimit and to quell any kind of national cohesion and uprising. They are also set up because they are policing Palestinians who are not to travel next to settlements, around settlements, through settlements, which are all built on confiscated Palestinian lands. And you asked, you know, sometimes these checkpoints are built around places where there are no settlements, but there will be. but there will be. All of Palestinian territory is marked for Israeli settlement and is marked for the removal of Palestinians. Palestinians have been steadily removed from their homes. They are demolished. Roads are built over them for Israelis only. Settlements are built on top of them. And Palestinians are ever contained into smaller and smaller tracts of land that the Trump administration just revealed in January will become their permanent Bantustans or reservations, where they will be able to practice this autonomy, or derivative sovereignty, but never a form of freedom, and they will be forever dominated. I want to switch really quick, because this is the concern of the family. In the aftermath of Ahmed's murder, Israel immediately started a propaganda campaign blaming Ahmed for his own death and alleging that he tried to ram his car into the checkpoint. This is a lie. This is an incredibly hurtful lie, but it's a systematic lie that Israel tells as it kills Palestinians and blames them for their own death. What we know is that Israel has done this systematically. We know that they have used this. As people have said, this is prepared and ready argument. We know that from May to October 2018, Israel killed 267 Palestinians in Gaza who were unarmed, that was supported by the Israeli police, by the Israeli military establishment, its political establishment, and it was rubber stamped as a shoot to kill policy by the Israeli High Court. We know among those murdered was paramedic 21-year-old Rezana Najjar, who had her hands up, was wearing a paramedic vest, and was shot in the back. When she was killed, the Israeli military released a doctored video claiming that Rezan said, "I am a human shield." What they failed to play was the rest of Rezan's clip, where she said, "I am a human shield on the here on the line, being a protective human shield, saving the injured." But the Israeli military doctored that video to say that she was a human shield for Hamas. And guess what? The entire world stopped asking questions. The moment you say Hamas, the moment you say Palestinian violence, the moment you say Palestinian resistance, it's as if we expect that to be a carte blanche to kill as many Palestinians as possible. They did it with Rezan. They did it with Iyad al-Halak. They did it with Ahmed yesterday. And right now, the family is demanding that Ahmed's body, his corpse, be returned. It is being withheld as a form of collective punishment. We are also demanding that the home be protected, because Israel has a policy of demolishing homes of Palestinians they consider alleged assailants without, of course, any kind of trial. We are demanding that the footage be released and atone and apologize and address the systematic violence. It bears to note that in 2017, the Human Rights Council at the UN examined the cases of Israel's systematic killings of Palestinians and concluded, quote, that Israel often used lethal force against Palestinians on mere suspicion or as a precautionary measure. Israeli soldiers kill Palestinians as precautionary measure. And the rest of the world accepts this because of how used to the loss of Palestinian lives we have become numb to. This is normalized. This amount of killing is normalized. And this is the context in which Ahmed now, his family is fighting for justice in his name, and is also mourning his life at the same time.
Nora Erekat, as you describe Ahmed, he was picking up his mom and his sister. His sister was going to be married last night. He was picking them up from the salon. His sister Iman fainted when she heard what had taken place, and he himself was going to be married in just a few weeks?
Indeed. So the other part of the story that doesn't add up, and frankly, one of the things about this is you're telling us these details, Amy, right? And so most listeners would think naturally, why would a young man, 27 years old, with his own T-shirt business, who's incredibly happy and smiling on the day of his sister's wedding, plan an attack against an Israeli checkpoint, which is basically a suicide mission? Why would he do that? Normal people will ask that, and normal empathetic people will say it is impossible. And yet, because of the dehumanization of Palestinians and the racism with which our stories are cloaked, there are some who might say, yeah, it's possible. Palestinians are driven by a hatred for Jews and are basically born in order to kill. As former Justice Minister Ayad Shaked had said, Palestinian mothers should be killed because they birth snakes. This is the discourse of the highest people in office in Israel, not of the random extremists, but of its representatives who represent them to the world, this so-called only democracy. And yes, Ahmed was incredibly proud of the home he had furnished and prepared for his wife to be. They had shared pictures of him in his home and had so much to live for and deserved to live and deserves justice and deserves our support in demanding justice and demanding accountability. This is not about one bad Israeli soldier, just as it's not about one bad cop ever. This is a system. It is an apartheid system. It is a settler colonial system that enshrines Jewish Israeli supremacy as a matter of law and policy on an international scale. And it is one that marks Palestinians for removal, exile, or death. And it is done with the full, unequivocal diplomatic, financial, military support of the United States and with the complicity of the international community. So it bears upon us to respond in this moment by supporting the Palestinian call for freedom, by doing the little that we can, by engaging in boycott, divestment, and sanctions for Ahmed, for Razan, for Iyad, to oppose the annexation, to oppose apartheid, to fight for freedom.
Noura Erekat, we want to thank you for being with us again. Our condolences to your family. Noura is a Palestinian human rights attorney, legal scholar, colleague of Juan's over at Rutgers, assistant professor at Rutgers University, and author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. Over 1,000 European MPs have written a letter opposing Israel's plan to annex parts of the occupied West Bank. Also, the final tweet, one of the tweets of Noura Erekat, our guest, after Ahmed died, they left him to bleed out like this for 1.5 hours. His name is Ahmed. He deserved to live. He deserved to dance tonight with his family to celebrate his sister. He deserved to dance at his wedding to nurture family, to live. This is not a picture of Ahmed, but of Israel's ugliness, she wrote.
That was Palestinian attorney and scholar Noura Erekat speaking on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez about the execution of her cousin, Ahmed Erekat, by the Israeli military at a West Bank checkpoint. We now turn, or I should say return, to the ongoing story of the attempts by the Zionist lobby to silence voices critical of Israel on U.S. campuses across this country. It doesn't end. And our coverage of the struggle will not end as long as it continues. Today we feature Professor Hatem Bazian of the University of California in Berkeley, along with two members of Students for Justice in Palestine at Tufts University, discussing this assault on free speech with Dale Spruzansky, editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. We begin with Dale Spruzansky's introduction.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us for our second webinar here at the Washington Report during this COVID pandemic. Thanks for taking time out of your day to join us. They used to say on the airlines, everyone has lots of options for flying. Everyone has lots of options for webinars, so we thank you for choosing ours today. So today we're going to be talking about Palestine campus advocacy, which is a topic we've been covering for quite a bit here at the Washington Report. In fact, we're going to discuss it here at this month in May at our annual Israel lobby conference that we had planned at the National Press Club. But obviously that has fallen apart and we will be rescheduled for March of next year. But in lieu of that, we have little 1 hour sessions here to keep everyone in the loop and engage on these important topics. And I would encourage people to check out our YouTube channel where you can watch talks by people such as Rabab al-Dahadi and Dima Halady, Maria LaHood, Barry Trachtenberg, and several students who have spoken at past conferences to really give you a better idea of what's going on college campuses. So of course, you know, attempts to limit freedom of speech regarding Palestine aren't limited to campus. Currently, 28 states have legislation that in some way, shape, or form limits freedom of speech regarding Palestine. But campuses really are a focal point of this battle. Palestine Legal, which works to help people who have been targeted by attempts to suppress their freedom of speech, in their latest study found that 3/4 of the cases are on college campuses. And of course, a common tactic, unfortunately, is to accuse students and professors of anti-Semitism. And this is done by using a definition of anti-Semitism adopted by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance that says that if you criticize Israel, it's anti-Semitic. And of course, that's a very dangerous track to go down and can cause lots of problems for students who are targeted by these campaigns. And of course, the situation's been bad for a while under multiple administrations, but it's certainly gotten worse under the current one. In December of this last year, Trump signed an executive order that adopted that IHRA definition. And with Kenneth Marcus as the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the Department of Education, who in his prior career targeted students on campus, we can only expect that cases targeting students are going to increase. And in Palestine Legal has found that has been the case since this executive order was signed last year. And this is not an isolated or small operation facing students. A 2018 Al Jazeera documentary found that the Israeli government itself is working with organizations based in the US to confront these students. And there's, of course, the Canary Mission, a website that seeks to defame students engaged in activities on campus and can really cause nightmares for them if they're seeking jobs outside of advocacy, which most of them are. And people Google their name and they come up on this website accusing them of horrible things. So to elaborate on this, we have three great speakers here today. Our first speaker will be Dr. Hatem Bazian. He's a senior lecturer at the Department of Near Eastern and Ethnic Studies at the University of California in Berkeley. He is also the chairman of the board of American Muslims for Palestine. And he's been actively involved with the SJP groups around the country for many years now. After that, we'll hear from two students from the Tufts University SJP chapter, Paolo and Hassan. For reasons I just described above, they asked for their last names to not be used during this, and they will be speaking by audio only, so that they can speak openly without fear of retribution from websites such as the Canary Mission. And they've recently on campus been targeted by pro-Israel groups after they won a campus award, which the university president later condemned, accusing SJP of having anti-Semitic sympathies. And they'll tell us all about that. But to begin with, we'll start with Dr. Bazian, who will provide an overview of the situation on campus these days. So thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. And it's really a pleasure to be part of this webinar. The Washington Report has been an institution in covering the Middle East, in writing about Palestine at a time where many people stayed away from it. So really, it's very important to continue to support and contribute and write to the Washington Report on Middle East affairs. In assessing the campus activism on campus as it relates to the current campaign of demonization, of targeting, of systematic singling out of SJP as an exception to policies. On the one hand, we need to recognize that this is an ongoing strategy, but at the same time, is actually to celebrate because it's coming because of success. So the fact that SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, GUPS, General Union of Palestine Students, and a host whole of other organizations around the country and the world have embraced Palestine and began to be engaged in effective work around BDS and highlighting the human rights violation is actually to be celebrated while taking stock of the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which I would say the term strategic affairs should be put between two parentheses, because it seems that they only have one play, which is to use power, might as their go-to. So one has to understand why the universities are being targeted and the students in particular. The universities often have been the landscape or the arena for new ideas, for movements to spring out, to challenges to the status quo that in a few years or sometimes over a 10-year period plus, it might begin to be part of the mainstream. So many of the ideas that gets to be embraced begins at the college campuses. You could think of the environmental movement. You could think of the United Farm Workers effort. You could think of a variety of movements that began at the campus because students are idealistic. That's very positive considering the lack of idealism in our country and the White House. They actually are able to spend time in engaging with other students that might be contemplating all types of ideas and causes. So the campuses are very, very important site. It's also grappling with ideas, with books, with articles, with materials. So Palestine has had almost a 40 to 50 year history, if not more. I actually found some writing from the 1960s where pro-Palestine activism at the time actually was connected to the Black Panther Party and the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam movement, issuing statements and participating in the effort, whether it's here in Berkeley, San Francisco, and other places around the country. Moving forward, I think the critical period for Palestine activism campus takes place in the 80s. As the Reagan administration began to engage in what is called low-intensity warfare in Latin America, it also went into a hyper-militarized political discourse that viewed Israel as a central piece of this strategy, which is countering the Soviet Union. So in this sense, Israel began to have a larger role during the Reagan administration as a result of this low-intensity warfare and also engagement in Africa, where the United States was engaged in Angola in supporting apartheid South Africa through the policy of reconstructive or constructive engagement. Activism on campus connected itself to those causes, domestically and internationally. Palestinian activists and pro-Palestine activists were in a major component of the anti-apartheid movement. They were a major component of the Central American Solidarity Movement. On the opposite end, what we find is the pro-Israel groups, including Hillel on campus, connected itself to protecting or almost opposing any type of activism relative to critiquing apartheid South Africa, because Israel was the major weapon supplier to South Africa, breaking the UN sanctions that was imposed on selling weapons to South Africa. So in here, Israel interest took precedent over human rights, over the idealism of students on campus mobilizing in that way. In a similar way, the work around Central American Solidarity Movement, where Israel also was a subcontractor with the United States, the Israeli Mossad facilitated and was contracted to provide training for the death squads in El Salvador and other places. So we also saw that some on college campuses that were pro-Israel were actually were bringing some of the most extreme right-wingers, supporters of death squads, to speak on college campuses, including the Arena Party at the time, to bring them on college campuses. And in essence, Israel and pro-Israel activists hitched their wagon to right-wing politics, to apartheid South Africa, to the Central American death squads type of logic. And as such, they began to actually move themselves out from politics that is based on justice, that's based on equality, based on fairness, and based on also on progressive trajectory within civil society. So in this sense, when the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs points to the Palestinians, pro-Palestinian activists, I think they should spend a lot of time looking at themselves in the mirror. Because the friends and the companies they kept have put them outside the normative civil society practices, normative embrace of the rule of law, of justice, of international law. And as such, they have chose to take that track. And it actually crystallizes during the Obama administration. I think if you look at how Netanyahu bounced around Washington, D.C., embracing every right-wing political figure within the Republican Party while attacking Obama, attacking Obama's policies, opposing the Iran deal, that resulted, I would say, in a major shift in the United States as it pertains to Netanyahu's standing and Israel's standing problem. Now, specifically on the university administration, the university is part of replicating the society. It's a microcosm of the society. Those who have the political leadership or the administrative leadership on the campus are all trying to maintain the boat without anyone rocking the boat, because it affects their possible funding from the state. It affects their communication with their corporate partners. It affects their donors. And therefore, you would think that they're operating an institution of higher learning. They are, but it is one that is highly controlled in order to reproduce replacement part for the economy, for the society. So pro-Palestine activists become that ingredient on campus that asks the difficult question. Why is it that we have a study abroad program with Israel in so many different universities, and Israel is the primary violator of human rights? Why is it that we have a journalism fellowship that takes graduate students in journalism to actually be almost toured into Israel to understand the situation on the ground from the occupier point of view? A journalist should not be in the business of being what you call wined and dined by in a state that is occupying and continue to violate the basic standing of international law, the Fourth Geneva Convention. Students also begin to ask questions as it relates to the university investment. Since we divested from South Africa, rightly so. We divested from Sudan, rightly so. We divested from a sweatshop type of corporate engagement, rightly so. But when it comes to Palestine, now we become divestment, boycott, divestment, and sanction is a form of anti-Semitism. Now, interestingly enough, some of those individuals that participated in promoting the boycott on Sudan for Darfur, or highlighting constantly the boycott and sanctions to be implemented on Iran, they flip the switch and immediately say that you're violating Israeli academic freedom if you boycott it. Well, aren't you violating the academic freedom of X, Y, and Z? The criteria in here, if a country is violating international law, if a country continues to occupy another people, if a country continues to build settlements, expand people, and basically use the Palestinian bodies as target shooting practice, that country should not have an engagement intellectually which assumes an equal engagement where Palestinians academics are not even allowed to breathe, let alone be actually able to freely go to their university back and forth. So in here, what we need is to point to the hypocrisy that is there. And I know we don't have much time, but let me conclude with the following, that the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs possibly have committed one of the primary strategic blunders in engaging in the United States relative to trying to actually silence people. The debate was about Palestine and Israel, and now the debate is about First Amendment rights. And I'd love to actually constantly debate and engage on First Amendment rights, because that's a winning ticket. And I would thank the Ministry of Unstrategic Affairs for choosing to move the goalpost. And I would say at the end of the day, whatever you spend $30 million to demonize, will not register vis-a-vis the First Amendment rights that are, I would say, a foundational piece, both for academia as well as the American society. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. That was excellent. I think it's great to point out that sort of hypocrisy that we see and that sort of reframing as a free speech issue, which I think all Americans get behind, even if they don't necessarily agree with the Palestinian cause. So with that, we'll switch over to Hassan and Paolo, students at Tufts University, SJP group, who've recently come under fire for their involvement in a deadly exchange program that had them receive an award from a campus group. And so if you two can just go ahead and explain what happens and sort of the evolution of this and what's going on campus, that'd be great. Thanks.
Yeah, so about 2 weeks ago, the Office of Campus Life at Tufts gave SJP the Collaboration Award for our work on the and the Deadly Exchange campaign. And specifically because we formed this large coalition with lots of diverse groups. And the next day, the administration released a statement saying that they disapproved of the award because of our affiliation with BDS, which they claim is anti-Semitic. And then interestingly, that morning, actually like the morning the administration released their statement already, many newspapers were writing articles with quotes from like large pro-Israel organizations like Stand With Us, for example, sort of smearing our campaign, calling the campaign anti-Semitic as well as us as a group anti-Semitic. The administration itself obviously only claimed we're anti-Semitic because of BDS, which is obviously false. They did not mention the campaign specifically. So since then, we've been mobilizing students and our communities to pressure the administration to retract the statement and apologize. And we've yet to have any response, but we're still pressuring them. Yeah.
Great. And I'm wondering, do you have any sense of who was behind this effort on campus? Were there particular individuals or groups that sort of really raised this issue?
So, like I said, it was really interesting how the very morning, I'm not sure about the exact timeline, but essentially immediately after the administration released their statements, like I said, newspapers had published articles with quotes about the situation from organizations like the ADL, Stand With Us. And even that morning, we were receiving tweets from either like random people on Twitter saying, you know, Islamophobic things, or sort of pro-Israel figures. For example, Adam Milstein tweeted at us. So that kind of suggests who may be behind it, as well as the Hillel on our campus released a statement recently after saying that they had been working with the administration in response to the award we received. So that's very suggestive, I would say.
Absolutely. I'm wondering if you can give us some insight into, to the extent that you can. I know that obviously you're not on campus likely these days, but based on your Facebook post explaining what happened, it looks like your statement was signed by a lot of different groups on campus. So that at least gives me the impression that the students, at least a significant number of them, seem to be behind you. Do you have any sense of how students on campus have responded to this and the support you've received from other groups on campus?
Yeah, I mean, the support has been immense. If you go on the Tufts University Instagram page, I don't know if their most recent post or the second most recent post is just flooded with comments from students saying how they feel about this and, you know, what it means for the university to basically call anti-Semitic a position that almost all Palestinians hold. Right? Like, what does that mean for a Palestinian student on campus for their identity essentially to be called anti-Semitic? So we've had a lot of support. even from some faculty who may soon release a statement, as well as, like, if you look at our statement, lots of like identity-based clubs, because this is who our campaign affects, like maybe primarily students of color who are negatively impacted when the university engages in police militarization. So those are the students who have shown like a lot of support to, you know, what's going on.
Also, if you decide to check out a lot of Tufts University students' Facebook pages, a lot of them have changed or like added a frame to their profile pictures saying we like support the Tufts SJP. And a lot of organizations as well as students have also signed on to the statement that we released from SJP.
Did you have any hope for the administration engaging you on this, or do you think this is just sort of going to be sort of a line in the sand that they drew and they're not really willing to even discuss it?
That's a good question. I mean, you can always have hope, right, that they will come to their senses or something. But even if they are absolutely not considering revoking the statement, it doesn't matter. They should still be, like, if anything, people should know, you know, what the university is doing and how they're behaving. So it wasn't really all about, you know, on the one hand, even if we don't get them to revoke their statement, the purpose is to, you know, possibly prevent them from silencing us further, even though obviously we want them to apologize and revoke their statement.
Right. Is there anything that people watching can do to perhaps help you guys sort of put more pressure on them and raise this issue?
Sure. So if you search Tufts Students for Justice in Palestine on Facebook, you can find our statement. And we have a email template that lots of students have used to tell our deans and president and provost, you know, how they feel about this statement and what it means to them and what the administration should do.
Great. I just want to maybe turn to Dr. Bazin again here and ask, you know, hearing this situation, how does it compare? Is it sort of par for the course with things that are happening on other campuses?
Well, I think it's very similar. When I heard about the systematic nature of the attack on SJP, that's normative because most likely what happened is the following, that the various Zionist and pro-Israel organizations got a wind of it, of what's happening. They mobilized all of their institutional capacities, and it was a full thrust attack on SJP and demanding the university administration to be the arm by which they beat back and push to demonize the SJP. So in here, what you need is to take, to hold the university president responsible, and you need to actually give him some level of understanding that he doesn't work for Netanyahu, that he is not a representative of the Israeli consulate, and that he actually represents and should look at the best interest of the students who are paying the tuition that are there as students. And he should not be defending the rights and the interest of a foreign country at the expense of his own students. Now, he might have his own position, whether he wants to support Israel or not. He could celebrate Israeli independence. He could wave the flag in the courtyard. I'll reserve the spot for him if he wants, and it could give him possibly a free lunch from the soup kitchen. But aside from that, many of these university presidents act as if they are a foreign desk in the Israeli embassy, and they look over and look for the interest of Israeli government. We saw this in relations to UC Berkeley when the students voted for the PDS resolution. We got the FOIA, Freedom of Information request, and it turned out that the university president or chancellor at the time was coordinating his statements with the ADL and the Israeli consulate while sending his dean to try to talk to the students that he is, you know, trying to be fair and to negotiate with them. So whenever the university administrators come to you, know for a fact that they have what you call a crisis management strategy in the back end, and you are the last group, SJP, that they're trying to look for your interest. And this is, again, I'm giving you advice right there. This is, they know the strategy, but you need to know it. It should be public, that the university administrators act to aid and abet the interest of Israel towards silencing the students and their activism. So again, that should be known, and they rarely investigate your opposition for what they do in on campus to demonize you on a systematic basis.
Right, and turning now to an audience question for Hassan and Paolo. Someone just would like you guys to maybe explain a little more what the Deadly Exchange initiative is that sort of lets you gain this award. That would be great.
Yeah, I don't know, Hassan, you can go ahead.
Oh yeah, so basically just the Deadly Exchange campaign at Tufts is a campaign that seeks to end the university's direct complicity in violence against Palestinians and to stop the militarization of our police. So a couple of years ago, Tufts, TUPD, Tufts University Police Department, was sent on a trip to Israel to get military training. And this 7-day trip, these policemen were just exposed to like military tactics, violence, and like discrimination against Palestinians. And a lot of, not just the TUPD, but a lot of police departments around the United States have gone on this trip. And when they came back from Israel, they carry these tactics. They use these tactics on like majority Black and Brown people. That's why a lot of the groups that have signed on to end the Deadly Exchange are like primarily POC groups. So we want to end this, and we want Tufts to apologize for going on the trip and to never go on the trip again.
Yeah, I would also add that like the resolution or referendum we are introducing into our student senate asks or demands that Tufts never send police like TUPD on any foreign military exchange trip anywhere, not just Israel, because it is important that our police not be militarized.
And I think it's also important to point out at sort of the national level that the Deadly Exchange program, one of its prime sponsors is Jewish Voice for Peace, a Jewish group. So the idea that, you know, your involvement in a campaign that has major backing by American Jews is anti-Semitic, it just seems, you know, I mean, pretty silly to me. Yeah. So we have one more question for you guys. Someone wants to know if you've... you have any sense that donors to the university perhaps are twisting the arm of the administration? Do you have any sort of information about that? Any sort of big Zionist backing there in the donors at the university?
Nothing specific about donors. I did forget to mention that some alumni were giving us their support and wanted to, talk to the administration. But about donors... No, we really don't have any specific information. It's very possible, but we don't know.
For Dr. Bazian here, someone wants to know, on a more general level, what the current efforts are to confront the Canary Mission. Are there any coordinated efforts right now to sort of confront that website?
I don't think there's any coordinated effort to speak of, but I think... the various pro-Palestine activists have been constantly highlighting the intrusive and problematic nature of Canary Mission, especially on college campuses. But I think having a systematic campaign on Canary Mission to try to highlight their McCarthyist type of strategy, which again, hearing that Adam Milstein is one of those individuals that was engaged. He's one of the funders that works in the circle of funding these right-wing, nefarious type of silencing organizations. And I think it's important to target the funding, target the support, and to make sure to constantly highlight it. For university administrators is actually to make sure that they know who is actually the source of the complaint and who's actually doing this mobilization. And I think the work around these different groups have to be a focus on educating the administrative structure on college campus. And I think most of administrators, they take their cue from pro-Israel organizations because of this constant contact that is taking place. You know, each Israeli consulate has an academic attaché that their role is to continue to engaging the universities. And there's a variety of different programs, whether it's joint research, study abroad, grants that are forwarded back and forth. All those create a particular consciousness within the administrators where they don't see Palestine, they don't see Palestinians. So you are actually erased, and the whole process of erasure of Palestine takes place at the administrative level.
Right. And I'm just wondering, Hassan and Paul, if you can sort of just talk about what it's like to operate on campus with this fear that you're going to have this website, you know, smear you. It's easy, you know, perhaps for someone like me who has a job to, you know, say some things and stuff like that. But, you know, what is it like to be a student and to have to confront this? I mean, you could just talk about that a little bit. That'd be great.
Yeah. Well, for me personally, I'll let you speak in a second, Paulo.
Sorry.
Like, I'm Palestinian. My parents are Palestinian. My grandma and grandfather were annexed from the West Bank in 48. So, like, me not being able to advocate for my people, not being able to say something and stand up for, like, who I am and my identity and stuff without being called anti-Semitic or without being put on this website that could, like, restrict me from finding a future job is it just, I don't know, it just like sucks. Like, I can't open my like mouth and like not get criticized, you know? So yeah, that I hate that. But then at the same time, like, I still want to advocate for my people. I still want to advocate for myself and for all the people that are like constantly going through this in Palestine. So
I mean, I agree, it's definitely very scary, and it's very different for someone like me than for someone who's Muslim or, you know, who already has sort of Islamophobic tropes used against them. But I think that nonetheless, like, I don't want to give Canary Mission too much credit. Like, they really don't stop us from doing anything. Like, we know how to organize ourselves and we know how to protect ourselves, and they may make us scared, but you know, it doesn't really stop us.
Right. Dr. Bazian, someone would just like to know, what are the things that perhaps beyond obviously just facilitating free speech on campus, you mentioned maybe study abroad programs and stuff like that. What are things that universities can do to sort of help, you know, bring the Palestinian narrative to greater light, you know, and obviously within the realm of academia and stuff like that?
Well, I'm a strong proponent of creating Palestine studies programs. So far on the U.S., we have two programs that are set up, one in Columbia University and then the one in Brown University. But I think what we need is to support and push so for SJPs and other student groups to begin to actually demand for Palestine studies programs. And to distinguish it from Middle East studies program, where often you center Israel as the point of departure. So a Palestine program that is not, in essence, always asking the question, so Palestine studies, what does it mean for Israel? And does Israel have the right to defend itself? Does the program, all those questions for me are framed around settler colonial questions, where the settler colonial rights to erase the indigenous population is actually take forefront. So creating and pushing for Palestine studies program. Second, also, these are proactive steps to push for study abroad program in Palestinian universities. So all those who come in like Smart Aleck tell you that you're violating Israel academic freedom, say, well, don't you advocate the university to actually have a study abroad program with Bir Zeit University and Najah University or Gaza University and so on? And why don't you advocate for Israel actually to open the borders for Gaza so students can actually can go and study if you are so much pro-academic freedom in this sense? So again, these are individuals that come with APAC, what you call prepared questions, that a PR firm has worked on them with a focus group, and they think that they actually can put those to use. So again, a study abroad program for the Palestinians that looked at. A third is to actually look at creating programs that can begin to examine the right of Palestinian refugees, right? But doing it in a comparative way as we speak about the rights of refugees and immigrants that are coming from Latin America or those who are crossing the Mediterranean, that to do it in a comparative way, to look at why are these people on the move? What caused their expulsion or movement since we're looking at the anniversary of the Nakba upon us? Those are very important ways. Another element is also to begin to actually constitute funding in the university with specifically Palestinian support directed to it. For example, I would love to have SJP Tufts University endowment, where SJP can no longer have to depend on the university or a bureaucrat that is thinking over, looking over his head, thinking that he's going to move up. And the way to move up is to shut down and close SJP. So, you know, put together campaigns to create these endowments that specifically say, this is a scholarship in the fall or the spring for the most active Palestine activist and academic person on campus, and do that. So these are positive, while I continue to encourage you to engage in the work on PDS. All of the Canary Mission, the Strategic Ministry of Strategic Affairs, the ADL, the Adam Milstein, the Daniel Pies, the Islamophobes, all what they want is to silence you, which means your power is in your voice, right? So word can change history, and therefore don't allow them by accepting to be silenced. They could throw as much money as they want, whether up or down with the interest rate, that's immaterial, that don't allow silence to be the outcome, and continue to raise your voice.
You have been listening to Professor Hatem Bazian speaking with Dale Suspransky of the Washington Report and two Tufts University students discussing the attempts to silence pro-Palestinian speech on U.S. campuses. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم